everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is the Red, White, and Rude, where politics and culture collide. And I'm here to bring it all to you. That said, we don't always talk about politics and culture, sometimes just culture. A lot of times it does mix because it deals with wokeism, indoctrination. I mean, that's just Hollywood, you know. As Andrew Breitbart once said, politics is downstream of culture. And what's that mean? That means what's happening in the country, politics, it affects politics eventually. So tonight we got a great show for you. We are going to talk about Mrs. Ryan Reynolds. Blake Lively faces backlash as Justin Baldoni and his lawyer turn the tables. And then from there, we're going to go to delays to fix woke. Has Ubisoft learned Assassin's Creed Shadows delayed again? And then we're going to talk about the legacy of Rush Limbaugh. So this podcast is actually a retake, but I shot it the first time around on Rush Limbaugh's birthday. He would have been 74. And I call this segment Talent on Loan, the unmatched legacy of Rush Limbaugh. Then we're going to close it out with a new segment, Culture Clashes, the Rude Rundown, a series of quick hits. Well, not so quick hits, but they're not going to be in-depth as I usually go. So let's get down to it. Let's talk about Mrs. Ryan Reynolds, Blake Lively versus Justin Baldoni, how it started. Well, this conflict between Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, it stems from their work on the film It Ends With Us. And that's where Baldoni was the director and the co-star. And the movie's based on Colleen Hoover's novel that portrays the story of, I was going to say Emily, but it's Lily Bloom, a young woman navigating love and domestic abuse. Now, this movie has been a box office success. It grossed over 350 million big ones worldwide and had a production budget of about 50 million. So that's significant profits. In fact, if you break that down and how films are broken down, it probably costs about $150 million when you count total costs. So you're looking at about $200 million profit there. That's some serious change. And for those of you checking out the picture here, if you're watching on YouTube and Rumble, to the audience out there who isn't, Justin Baldoni, not quite the handsomest guy around. And then there's a husband, Ryan Reynolds, and he has implicated himself in this debacle. And there is Blake Lively, not looking so lovely there. Woo! There's true love. All right. So the tension escalated when Lively filed a sexual harassment complaint with the California Civil Rights Department this past December. So December 2024. Come on. There we go. She alleged harassment in a smear campaign by Baldoni and his team. So what were Lively's allegations? Well, she accused Justin Baldoni of sexual harassment, claiming he entered her trailer uninvited. Spoiler alert, according to the evidence, he did not. While she was undressed or breastfeeding, and added unconsented kissing scenes to the script. Bro, you could have done much better. Why? Why, Justin? Why? She further alleged that after raising these concerns, Baldoni and Wayfair Studios retaliated by launching a social manipulation campaign to damage her reputation. She also claimed that Baldoni's team used the media via the PR firm to amplify negative stories about her, intending to destroy her public image. I have to be honest. The first I heard about this was when Blake Lively began to smear Baldoni. Now, we don't know exactly what happened here. So let's review the evidence. The evidence points to Lively having worked with the New York Times together to create an article called "We Can Bury Anyone Inside a Hollywood Smear Machine," highlighting her allegations. And she suggested Baldoni was involved in the smear campaign against her. Well, so early on, I was like, oh, well, look at this, another Hollywood idiot. You know, why is he doing this to the ever-popular Blake Lively? But as the story unfolds, things that make you go, Baldoni pushed back, or rather his lawyer, they're not pushing back. They're like, we me take off the kid gloves here. Bam! Bam! He's filed a $250 million libel lawsuit against the New York Times. And he's alleged the paper published a story filled with inaccuracies and misrepresentations. I heard his lawyer, and it really sounds like they got a hell of a case. His side claims that the Times article relied heavily on Lively's self-serving narrative and omitted crucial context from text messages and other communications. So in essence, what he's saying, people, is that Lively and the New York Times, the writers, came together and worked together on the article. How? Well, they asked her for information. She provided it. They did nothing, absolutely nothing, to get Baldoni's side. So that's not reporting. That's a hit piece. And here's what they do to try to cover themselves. Because of social media, it's been exposed. Back in the day, they could be able to go to court. Well, Your Honor, we actually gave the defendant their time to respond. You know, we get them time to respond. Well, now it comes out their time to respond is like an hour. They spend months writing this article, a hit piece, and then they'll give the other side, well, we're going to publication here in about an hour. What you got to say about this? And that's documented. There's been more than enough documentation that they do that. I don't know if they did that here. It's likely they probably did. You know, they assert that Lively's allegations are false and that she was the one orchestrating the smear campaign against Baldoni. Adding to that, Baldoni's team contends they were not given adequate opportunity to respond or provide their side of the story before the Times published the article. Just as I said, you know, Mr. Baldoni, I am the intern at the New York Times here. I am a hardcore leftist, so listen up well, you dumbass. You got 30 minutes. Okay, I feel good today. I'll give you an hour to respond to this story before we got her print. I mock it because they do that, especially the Washington Post. So what he's suggesting is that the paper did not follow proper journalistic procedures for fairness and accuracy. And I agree. So during the editing and promotional phases of It Ends With Us, Lively alleges that Baldoni ostracized her from key decisions and public appearances, which is actually the exact opposite. In essence, she's a mean girl and kind of took over. She used the coattails of her husband. Because let's be honest, Blake Lively's a nobody. In the grand scheme of things in Hollywood, she's attached to Ryan Reynolds, which makes her powerful via coattails. She had her own version of the film cut. She threatened not to promote the film if her cut wasn't considered. And that led to Baldoni being excluded from joint press conference events, or rather press events, and not being allowed to introduce the film at its premiere. Imagine that, the director. Mean girl, mean girl. So what has this cost Baldoni? Well, let's figure it out. Excuse me. He was dropped by his talent agency, WME, and rumor has it, and I have not confirmed this, but I believe it, that is the same talent agency that represents Ryan Reynolds. This is a massive professional setback. That's a powerful agency. And to be cut loose, woo! So losing representation will affect his future opportunities, networking, and obviously they can help guide his career, and that's gone. Like I said, his lawyer's coming out swinging. This talent agency will probably be named in the lawsuit as well. You know, this Me Too attitude is going to cost people. You can't just fire somebody because of false allegations. You need to hear it out. Now, they may say, oh, it's a private company. Well, nah, that's not how it works anymore. Baldoni lost the voices of solidarity. Where is some freaking leftist organization? But in Hollywood world, it's a big thing. It's a reputational hit. Obviously, this $250 million lawsuit is going to cost him. His lawyer is not cheap. He's one of the best, but is not cheap. So, and the litigation is also going to extend out, not just from the New York Times. More on that in a second. So these costs are going to be ongoing, and they will be significant. There's also the public backlash he got. Hey, I was like, what a bum, man, when I first heard this. But it has shifted a bit more towards his side, you know. But at the end of the day, there's a loss of trust, less endorsements or opportunities, and obviously a tarnished public image, not to mention the career damage. His future in Hollywood is up in the air. Even if he is exonerated, Ryan Reynolds has a lot of power and influence, and Hollywood. He may come off as a nice guy, but he's not. These people are all ruthless behind the scenes. This could actually backfire in the end against Reynolds, too. So there's that to worry for him to worry about. So he's got to tread carefully here. He's got the squeaky clean all-American boy image, but we shall see. There's also a personal toll on him, emotional stress. And this is serious in this case because we're talking his career. This is David versus Goliath. You know, and obviously with less opportunities comes less financial wages or less earnings, rather. Projects are pulled, endorsements lost. His earnings potential would decrease. Then there's a social and industry isolation. All of a sudden, the phone calls are going to dry up. Hey, man, there's a party here. Dude, who are you calling? Just about don't hang that phone up, bro. We ain't calling him. That's what happens. So what are some of the legal argument strategies and potential consequences here? Well, for the New York Times, they're praying the Sullivan Act holds. The Supreme Court decision saying, yeah, we know they're guilty, but we're going to set the bar even higher because it's the media, the print. It's a publication. It's a news media. And the Constitution tells us to protect it. No, you activist pigs of judges. They should not be protected above and beyond. They should be protected no different than the average person, because I'm tired of the New York Times and all their anonymous sources. And I was in the news media. Those anonymous sources from the New York Times, like the Russia hoax anonymous sources, they were lies. What they're doing in today's day and age is they say, well, according to our anonymous sources, well, according to my anonymous sources, Ryan Reynolds was licking the rear end of this guy, according to my anonymous sources, the same ones used by the New York Times. See, but he could sue me if I started printing stuff out like that and could win. But if it's the New York Times, it would hold it to a higher bar, and that's wrong. And so that's why you get sometimes out of court settlements from these media organizations, because they cross the line so badly. They know, oh God, we can't endanger the Sullivan Act. So let's settle out because we are guilty as guilty. You know, and ABC, Good Morning America, George Stephanopoulos, they settled out because they would have been taken in the cleaners. And the Sullivan Act would have been tarnished. See, once they lose a major lawsuit, it's like the door. It's like Moses in the Red Sea, partying, and all the lawsuits come in. Once precedent is set, it's doomsday for the media. And their day is coming. Mark my words. So, the Times has a lot to lose at this hippies. We're in an era now where people are fighting back. For Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds, you know, Baldoni's lawyer stated there's a massive lawsuit coming their way. And if Baldoni's counter-narrative holds in court, Lively will face defamation charges for these allegations, potentially damaging her and her husband, Ryan Reynolds. Financial. Lively will be a nobody. She'll be an outcast in this. The only reason she gets gigs is because she's Mrs. Ryan Reynolds. I mean, let's be honest. That's about it. So she stands to lose a lot. Who wants to work with a woman who's going to lie about you? Who you got to watch your back. Oh, my back. Get the knife out of there. Get the knife out. You know, because that's who Blake Lively allegedly is, according to Baldoni, from what I see from the evidence. Oh, yeah. And that's going to hurt Reynolds. He may be well-liked by the public, but we don't know what kind of person he is behind the scenes. And to be quite frank, I don't care. But if you're playing God and trying to destroy a guy's life, then I hope you burn in hell. So, what are some of the legal arguments on textual evidence and privacy claims? Now, there's some cool stuff here. This lawyer was not messing around, people. So Baldoni's lawyer claims that text show Lively had invited Baldoni into her trailer while she was breastfeeding. Boom, 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 pumping. Specifically, Friedman, that's the name of the lawyer. I have his name somewhere. It's down in my notes. His last name is Friedman. He argued that specifically Friedman highlighted a text message where Lively allegedly wrote, I'm just pumping in my trailer if you want to work out on our lines. To which Baldoni responded, copy. Eating with the crew will head that way. Now, she's saying that they barged into her trailer. This shows they did not. He entered uninvited with boom, 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 boom. You know what? I would never do that. I'm like, call me when you're done breastfeeding. You know, it's. I just don't want to deal with that. I am uncomfortable in that situation. But I guess Baldoni is a feminist. He views that as natural. And, you know, I'm tired of people saying that's natural. It is natural. But so is urinating. So is hitting the head. You know, do you do that in public for people to come and watch? No. It's natural. You know, certain things I'd rather are should be done in private. I think breastfeeding is one. That's just me. That's just me. But I don't care for that. So then there's misrepresentation of text exchanges. Friedman has argued that the text messages included in Lively's lawsuit were cherry-picked. And that's common, especially when you're in a PR battle. And it appears that Lively's and Reynolds there stripped necessary context and deliberately spliced text messages to mislead. These claims were made in response to allegations that Baldoni's PR team was planning a smear campaign. Friedman states that these messages were part of an internal scenario planning and not indicative of any actual intent to harm Lively's reputation. So, what's this mean? It means if he has evidence, she's kind of screwed. You know, if it's true, like just the breastfeeding one or the breast pumping one, that suggests that her complaints about privacy were taken out of context or exaggerated to make him look bad. This could set a precedent in the media if Baldoni wins. So if there's any inkling that the Reynolds are going to lose and the Times are going to lose, they will settle out of court. And they will obviously probably include the talent agency in this lawsuit as well. Or probably if they win here, the talent agency, screw, they can be sued. Because they fired him for allegations that were not true. And that firing in and of itself also damages. Well, he was let go by WMA, man. Stay away from him. There's been a significant public discourse on social media platforms. When this first came out, everybody was against Baldoni. Now it's kind of like shifting. Blake Lively, mean girl. Blake Lively. You a dog. So how should media outlets report these allegations? Maybe report the truth. Get both sides. Now, Ryan Reynolds has not been directly named in legal actions. You know, the real power of this couple. She lives off his coattails. His involvement has been referenced. But Baldoni's lawyer has accused Reynolds of mocking Baldoni in a scene from his movie Deadpool and Wolverine. And I saw the scene. I'm like, yep, that's mocking it. Now that we know the story, I'm like, yep, he's mocking it. And that means Reynolds was using his power to help destroy Baldoni. Hey, I don't know how you do that in court, but the lawyer will make sure to tie it together. In essence, it's a personal, public, and legal fallout for Reynolds and Lively that they face. And Reynolds, all he did was add fuel to the fire. Reynolds has got a great PR in terms of how we see them. This will damage it if stuff starts to leak out specifically about him. Fans are fickle. They'll turn on you on a dime. So, you know, it's like I look at these actors, actresses, I'm like, I don't care about them. They're not making my life any better or any worse. You know, they're just people too. So given the high profile nature, both parties and the potential of a mutual reputational damage, there's always a possibility of an out of court settlement. I think Baldoni has everything to gain with his lawsuit by salvaging his reputation, and they have everything to lose. Brian Friedman, that's the name of the lawyer. Very, very, very good lawyer. He's been very vocal. He's been like a pit bull. Discussing the case in various interviews and planning further legal action against Lively and Reynolds. And both sides are preparing to court. Now playing the victim, the Reynolds, you know, Mr. Tough Guy, Deadpool, Deadpool. You know, that's the other thing is these fools start to believe they are who they act, that they're acting, you know. But now they're playing the victim. Why is everybody mean to me? I'm Ryan Reynolds. I'm the world's greatest actor. I'm Miss Blake Lively. I'm a power couple. I'm a nobody, but I'm married to him. I'm somebody. Why? Why are you picking on me? That's what they're doing right now. They're saying that their family and livelihood is in jeopardy. Yet they're the ones who started this. It's not a very endearing quality. What about the potential harm, or not potential, what about the actual harm they've caused Baldoni? I mean, if she sent that text, hey, I'm pumping, just come on in, brother, and check me out while I'm pumping, we'll rehearse these lines. I'm like, no, senorita, you go pump first, and then I come afterwards. Baldoni being a dumb feminist, never trust a man who says he's a feminist. You know, that's what I knew about Baldoni. So when all this came out, I'm like, yeah, typical. It turns out it was not. I was wrong. I could be wrong here, too. All this is alleged. But in essence, what's happening here is the Reynolds are trying to shift public sympathy by focusing on their own struggles. I'm struggling. Oh, my God. Do you know how hard it is to live off of $500 million? So this is obviously a legal battle that's just getting started. And it's going to affect a lot of lives. WMA, Ryan Reynolds, Blake Lively, Ryan Reynolds. Why am I involved? Well, you got yourself involved, brother. And obviously Justin Baldoni and his partner. This will influence how stories are told. And I hope the New York Times gets hammered. Because you're going to get his side. That's not journalism. That's a hit piece. I will, as always, keep you up to date with what's going on, as this is going to get juicy, but there's probably gonna be a little here as the paperwork, and we'll get a story here or there. And why do I know I'll give you an update? Well, I'm gonna give you another update here. Let's close this out. Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds, those poor little sad creatures, are facing the onslaught of the world famous Justin Baldoni. Wrong. We're going to keep up with this in terms of what happens to Baldoni and how the Reynolds, specifically Ryan, tries to influence his power in Hollywood to destroy them. But with the truth of the matter, with Friedman as their lawyer, I don't think they were counting on that. Stay tuned. All right, let's move on. Delays to fix woke. Has Ubisoft learned Assassin's Creed Shadows delayed again? So, isn't that something? I go from Hollywood to gaming. I can do it all. So the background, Assassin's Creed Shadows is obviously a pivotal title in the Assassin's Creed series, and it's been developed by the French gaming company Ubisoft. Did I tell you I don't like the French? You bail their asses out. Not once, not twice. Then we defend Europe. They create all these socialist programs at our expense because they don't have to spend billions over since World War II, and they're probably in the trillions now if you actually think about it. In defense, we handle all that, and they create all these social programs. They're soft. They're as soft as they come. I mean, when they were bombing Libya, what was it, 10 years ago or something? Hey, the U.S., we ran out of bombs. We ran out of bombs. Can you give us bombs? I'm digressing. I just do not like French. I do like a couple of their movies, though. I check it out on Netflix. Anyway, Ubisoft is famous for its open world action adventure series, Assassin's Creed. It's actually one of the most successful, if not their most successful franchise. And it really impacts their financials and obviously the company's reputation. So this game, Assassin's Creed Shadows, was originally set for release in November 15, 2024. There were no issues in terms of the delay. Then the delay came out, and I'll tell you why. It's delayed to February 14th. They're not going to make that. Now it's being delayed to March 20th. They want another month. And they're talking about incorporating player feedback and to polish the game to avoid a negative reception, some of the recent titles. So why did they delay it? Well, most of us in the industry who follow gaming, which I am one, talk a lot about the wokeness of it. So the truth of the Assassin's Creed series, the first one was set in the Middle East. It was a Middle Easterner who was the protagonist. Then it was Italy. It was an Italian. Then it was America, and it was an Indian, along with an Englishman. You got to play as both in the first game. And that's on and on. They set one in Egypt. He was Egyptian. Set one in it was like Bahala, so some Swede or something like that. White guy. Set in white country. One Greek guy. So you get it. So now we're living in a woke era, the George Floyd era, and Ubisoft wants to get in on it. Now, there are cultural issues between Asians and Blacks. So what do? They give this guy who has 13 lines in Japanese history, and they claim he's a samurai, say there it's historical fact. It's not. He was never a samurai. He was actually bought by his Japanese owner when he was brought over as a slave. He was an interesting figure. He was tall, Black. Most Japanese have never seen that, so the warrior bought him. Never a samurai. And yet, so Ubisoft created these lies, and they were claiming it as truth. Massive historical inaccuracy, not to mention So you, why do you have a black guy, an African, playing as a protagonist in Japan? Everybody was clamoring for a Japanese one to be played as an assassin, a Japanese, a shogun samurai. Not a black guy who was never a samurai, and then you're claiming he's a samurai because you want to be woke. We're talking about the ultimate DEI, 13 sentences in history, and all of a sudden you're being quoted from this 400-page book that is based off of 13 sentences. And there's a whole story in there. We'll get into that in a second. But in essence, it was a massive historical inaccuracy with the character's name being Yasuka. He's a protagonist. It's the first time a non-local character has been in, has been the central protagonist in any Assassin's Creed game. They, as I've obviously said, or as I've said, they've obviously overstated the historical truth here. They just flat out lied. So then where do the 13 lines come from? Some Jesuit letters about Yasuka's arrival as a slave, pretty much. He was owned, then he met with Nobunaga, who pretty much bought him. And there's also a biography of Nobunaga where he's briefly mentioned there. And then there's Matsudari's Letada's diary, a brief note confirming Yasuki's presence during some key events. So they took these 13 lines, created all this history, which was a lie, and they tried to push that. Then they try to tell you, no, you're wrong. You don't know history. Okay, so these white Frenchmen, they're telling Japanese people, these are people in Japan, they're telling, you don't know history. Well, it's my country, my culture. I know my culture is what they were saying. So the backlash just kept growing and growing and growing. And then somebody at Ubisoft said, oh, essay, or whatever the French say, you know, Skull and Bones sucked. We didn't sell any of that. Oh man, X Defiant, that sucked too. We didn't make much sales in that. Oh man, Mario Rabbit Sparks of Hope just a couple years ago. That sucks. Man, our game sucked. We can't sell. Man, if this game tanks, we're screwed. But what about Star Wars Outlaws? Oh no, that sucked too. We sold only 1 million units in a month, and it cost like 300, 400 million to make. We'd be screwed if Assassin's Creed, the Black Samurai, doesn't make it. So what else constituted this backlash that made them realize, hey, we've had nothing but woke games and they have not sold for squat. Maybe we need to look at what we're doing here. Then all of a sudden it came out, well, they had DEI hires, DEI as experts that were considered historical. Yet they had no direct experience in Japanese history. They focus on diversity initiatives. The 400-page book is called African Samurai, based off of 13 lines of history by Thomas Lockley and Jeffrey Gerard. In fact, they're the ones who were updating the Wikipedia and telling Ubisoft, you got to reference Wikipedia here, without telling them that they were the ones updating that. This blew up so bad, he got in trouble at the university he taught in Japan. I don't know what became of it yet. But odds are he's not long for that university because there was backlash in Japan. 13, think about it, 13 lines of historical data. And they're saying, oh, this book is 400 pages of history, man. Based on 13 lines. I just can't get over that. You don't get the 400 pages without just flat out creating fan fiction, which is what Thomas Lockley did. Sign him up, Marvel Comics, because that's what you got here. And yeah, he's tried to portray that as historical. And it almost worked. It almost worked. You see, in the media, we have everything from Japanese beliefs here. And in Japan, they have the truth in their own beliefs. They don't know what's happening around across the world in terms of how people see their history, etc. And the worlds collided here, and they found out. It led to significant criticism from within Japan, including government officials and celebrities. They highlighted the cultural insensitivities. You're going to have a black man who, we have issues with the black culture, coming here killing all Japanese? It's no different than if there was a white KKK guy killing everybody in Compton. Same concept here. That's a cultural insensitivity we're talking about, along with the historical inaccuracy. And that's why most of us believe the game was delayed. I think what's going to happen when the game comes out again, you're going to be able to play as a Japanese protagonist. That's what I think. We'll see. There's been no public statements or trailers or anything about the game since they delayed it in terms of what we're going to get. Oh, and the other thing was the inaccuracies. You know, the villages, the temples, the weapons. It was all inaccurate. Not all of it, but there were chunks of inaccuracy they were claiming to be accurate. So much for those DEI historical experts. So as we approach release date of Assassin's Creed Shadows, March 20th, 2025, I will not buy it. I have not bought an Assassin's Creed game, oh God, in 10 years now. In fact, I got one that I still have yet to play, and I will play it. It's a great game. What happened was the game just got so big, so long, and so repetitious that it takes you like 60, 80, 100 hours to complete the game. I'm like, just give me a game that takes 10 or 15 hours to play. I'm a grown man who still loves the game, but I don't have my whole life to commit to it. It's what I call the stupefying of American kids. Instead of learning STEAM or STEM in school, they run home the game. They don't go out. They become fat little blobs. God, we're so unhealthy, and games don't help. But anyway, I'm digressing. Since the most recent delay was announced, again, there's been no new gameplay footage or substantial updates in terms of being shared publicly by Ubisoft. And Ubisoft is in trouble. They are financial. This game, they have a lot riding on it. Their company's future is riding on this game. And I'm not kidding. Gaming studios are closing left and right. Why? Because the wokeness has entered them. And now with social media and with Elon buying X, we're spreading the word. Don't buy this game, DEI. Like Dragon's Age Veilguard, that bomb. Why? They're like promoting transgenderism, gayness. And all that. That's it. That's your shtick. That's fine. But a young child shouldn't be exposed to that until they're young adults. Instead, we're trying to indoctrinate. I mean, it's like TikTok. In Japan, their TikTok isn't like ours, which is nothing but TNA and booty. And there's a lot of good stuff, funny stuff, and entertaining stuff there. But in China, they're like, no. You're going to learn STEM. And we're wondering why everybody's catching up. We used to have about a 30-year gap in technology, no more. We are soft. And wokeism is destroying everything. So we'll see how Ubisoft addresses these controversies with the historical accuracy, character representation, and their overall gameplay. But the overall gameplay is not too bad. It's just too big, too long, too repetitious. I will keep you updated. All right, let's move on to talent on loan. The legacy, the unmatched legacy of Rush Limbaugh. I have talent on loan from God. Those were the words that Rush Limbaugh would say. A man who not only reshaped the landscape of AM radio, but he also became a cultural icon for conservative America. It's been a few years now since he passed. In fact, it's hard to believe it's been 4 years. Oh, 5 years. Yeah, he died at 70. He would have been 74 today or yesterday when I originally did this. But I don't know what happened. But my producer said, "Essay, you got to reshoot this. We couldn't hear you. You couldn't hear this wonderful voice." But anyway, that's why I wanted to do this. He would have been 74 today. He passed, I want to say 2021 or 2020. Let me see, 2021 at the age 70. Yeah, 4 years ago. It's hard to believe it's already been 4 years. When he passed, I was sad because I was like, man, our biggest voice, our biggest conservative voice, our most entertaining conservative voice is gone. I have talent on loan from God. God called him back. That's how I view it. So let's talk about Rush Limbaugh. Record-breaking listenership, pivotal role in political discourse. He saved AM radio, touched the lives of millions through his charities and through his radio, and he left an indelible mark in the heart of this nation. He was born January 12, 1951, and would have been 74 years old. Began his broadcasting career in Southeast Missouri State with his own radio show in college. Then moved to Sacramento in 1984, the year I graduated from high school, to host the Rush Limbaugh Show on KFBK, and that launched his national career. From there, he moved to New York City 4 years later, 1988, where his show became nationally syndicated. Now, I didn't start listening to Rush until about 2012, I want to say 2010, right around there, maybe 2008. I can't remember. But he relocated to New York City when he made that move, and he hosted the Rush Limbaugh Show on television from 1992 to 1996. You know what? Let's pop up a picture of Mr. Rush Limbaugh here for those of you who may have forgotten who he was. Let's see here. Oops, wrong one. Man, where's my producer when I need him, S.A.? Here we go. There is the great one. That's him, this big picture, his later years. On the right is his big man years there in the middle, though. Woo, he was a big boy. You know, he was always a big guy, but he got his health together, and it was lung cancer that took him out. He loved his cigars. We don't know what causes lung cancer. It's one of those anomalies. There's people who don't smoke a lick and they get lung cancer. It's just one of those things. Anyway, he hosted the Rush Limbaugh Show on television from 1992 to 1996. If I remember correctly, it was produced by Roger Ailes, who went on to create Fox. I'm shocked that he did not put him on the Fox TV show, or I bet he tried and Rush said no. He also authored several bestsellers, including The Way Things Ought to Be and See, I Told You So, 1992 and 1993, and that solidified himself as a thought leader in conservative circles. And he also wrote the Rush Revere series of children's books, which were also national bestsellers. And those people hated that because he spoke the truth about what July 4th meant, what Thanksgiving really, the true history, not this indoctrinated lie or the lies of the 1619 Project. And they hated him for that, especially when he started winning awards. They did everything to ban him from these awards. And they eventually succeeded, but not the first year. So most listenerships say that he peaked at around 15 million. In reality, when he died, he was like in the 30 million of unique individuals, not just, you know, 30 million total listeners, people, same people every day, 30 million per week. He owned radio. Show was syndicated on 650 stations across the U.S. He was the only show I would listen to, where if I missed the episode, usually because I was traveling, I still listen to those older episodes, be a week or two. Oh, and I listened to them. He was that entertaining, and you could always learn something. There are shows like Mark Levin, they just grate on you. Glenn Beck, Rush was entertaining and informative. What people don't realize about Rush Limbaugh in the 80s and 90s, he revitalized AM radio. AM radio was dying because of FM dominance. So what he did was, his show was so popular, you know, he licensed it out to AM stations. They could start charging a whole boatload and compete with AM. They were in terms of charging advertisers. So an AM station in a small market might only have a few thousand listeners. They carry Rush Limbaugh's show because it was syndicated, and their numbers would jump to the tens of thousands from a couple thousand. And that allowed the station to charge more for advertisements. So his show also pioneered new media technologies, including podcasting and streaming. He was into that. He was smart. It helped maintain and expand his influence and his audience. Because our habits have changed. I don't listen to AM radio. I listen to podcasts now. So he was, in essence, a conservative voice for the working conservative. Because all political talk was pretty much center left or leftist, including the media masquerading as centrist but promoting progressivism. So, for example, a factory worker in the Rust Belt could listen to him during their lunch break, knowing he was getting actual conservative talk, one of the few places he could hear their side of political and cultural concerns. And he articulated it in a way that resonated with the average Joe. And that was in contrast to the mainstream media. This is the McLaughlin Report by Ryan, Mr. McLaughlin, an intellectual to you stupid there, blue-collar people. Rush Limbaugh was a working man's working man. He transformed talk radio by blending political commentary with humor and listener interaction. He was polarizing. While presidential candidates on the Republican side all wanted to be aligned with him, to make it seem as if he was endorsing them, because he never endorsed anybody. They wanted to be liked by him to try to get conservative votes. He also polarized because he spoke truths. Bill Clinton started the polarization of Rush Limbaugh. He hated the fact Rush Limbaugh had this big megaphone, and it was creating this political opposition to him that would not have been there without Rush Limbaugh. And that's since all the media was pro-Democrat, leaning center-left at best to show some neutrality, but in practice, never truly representing the conservative point of view. He gave voice to us, the opposition. And before the internet and immediate fact-checking, they would just flat-out lie. They even made up quotes about him. Like when he was trying to be a minority owner for the St. Louis Rams, papers just made up quotes saying he said this. He never said it. And eventually he's like, you can't sue every damn paper. And he didn't care. Because if he was truly racist, he would have been thrown off the air. He wasn't. If you listen to Rush, you go, well, where's the racism? He had blacks who would call up and say, you know, I used to believe you're a racist. Then I actually listened to you one time. I was like, damn, I like this guy. Oh, every week he'd have calls like that. He would combine personal anecdotes with political discussion. And I love that about him. You know, so again, you learn and we're entertained. In contrast, you have Mark Levin's heavy-handed approach, and that's tiresome. And then he becomes mean. And what's worse is when he misunderstands what a caller is doing, and he just yells at him. I haven't listened to Mark Levin in years. He may be brilliant in many ways, but he can't carry Rush's jock. Neither can Glenn Beck. Neither can Clay Travis, who thinks he can, but he can't. Rush would explain political issues through humorous analogies. He would compare the U.S. economy to a family budget. And he was funny in this sense. Bo Snerdly, which was a pseudonym for James Golden, his call screener, he would come on the air to be the official Obama criticizer. It was satirical. And it was intended to represent the black conservative, thereby diversifying the voices heard. And it was sarcasm. You know, but he was called to the mat and lied on, like when he made comments about Donovan McNabb on ESPN's Sunday NFL Countdown 2003. Limbaugh said that the media wanted McNabb to do well because he was black. And that was true. That was my industry. I'm like, yes, that is true. I see it with my own reporters. And that's their significant controversy. Racist, racist. See, you can't say anything. Only recently, since Obama, is when America had enough with Latinos, Asians, blacks, conservative blacks, whites, and now we're pushing back. And here's what people don't know. Michael Irvin backed Rush Limbaugh. So yeah, what he's saying is true. Quote, Rush is right, unquote. But you see, it was the Eagles defense that was winning games. They wanted to say it was Donovan McNabb. Donovan McNabb was a solid quarterback. He wilted under pressure, but he was a solid quarterback. He deserved to be in the NFL. Solid. And then he was, like millions of other Americans, got addicted to opioids through probably, I can't remember exactly, but he had some injury or something like that. He got addicted, you know, and then he avoided felony charges by entering a rehab program. But he was also a philanthropist, raised tens of millions of dollars throughout his career for Marine Toys for Tots, where he frequently hosted events and drives for the program that provide millions of dollars and toys for children in need during the holidays. The Leukemia Lymphoma Society raised awareness and funds. Support for veterans. He loved veterans. The Twin Towers or something like that, he gave a lot to that. He supported various veteran organizations, including financial assistance, advocating for better treatment of veterans, and helping to organize golf tournaments and raise funds, things like that. You know, and then he talked about his lung cancer issues a lot, and that kind of humanized him. Rush Limbaugh had like about 30 million weekly listeners. They say 50 million, but think of it this way. They keep saying 10 million. Only now have they raised that 10 million illegal aliens number because of the last 4 years. But man, Coulter, you know, gosh, she gets on my nerves, but she's a brilliant writer. And she lays it out why they were 30 million and they kept saying 10 million. They kept saying 10 million to minimize it. And that's what the critics try to do. Oh, you only have 15 million. No, he was up to, I want to say, like 36 million. And it was growing. His show was growing. If his show was still around today, he would undoubtedly be an even bigger hit right now because of what Democrats, Joe Biden and Kamala, or Horizontal Harris, as I like to call her, based on how her career trajectory has gone. Rush Limbaugh, rest in peace. You have entertained us. And as you stated, you were talent loaned from God. God has called you back. We're all going to be there one day. Until then, rest in peace. All right. Let's get ready to close this out with Culture Clashes, the Rude Rundown. So, man, I hate that. I kept that image up the whole damn section. My producer always jumps on me on that, and he's right. So let's do the Rude Rundown here, where we're going to present a series of stories based on what's happening in the news. And we're going to start out with Zuckerberg and more free speech. Mark Zuckerberg has really, or some months back, admitted in the letter to the House Judiciary Committee that the government pressured Meta to censor content, targeted conservative viewpoints on COVID-19, targeted those supporting Trump, those supporting the 2A, and election interference. Hunter Biden laptop. Zuckerberg is saying he wants more transparency and content moderation, including creating an oversight board with more conservative voices on there. He's advocating for less censorship, arguing that users should be able to see and judge political messages for themselves. And I agree with that. He's been criticized by the left. Hey, you're going to allow misinformation. Really, the truth, I mean, having an opposing voice is misinformation. COVID-19, anybody? If you take the vaccine, he won't catch COVID. If you take the vaccine, you can live longer. My heart. When you fall over. I've never seen more. I remember I was arguing with a pro-vax idiot. Well, William, you know, people die from that, whatever it's called. You know, young people die just dropping dead. I'm like, dude, have you seen how many soccer athletes? And then when the Buffalo Bills guy dropped, you know, it was like, yeah, that's just not COVID. You know, we don't know if it was or not, but there are, I mean, it got to the point where people are now not telling you what they died of when they dropped dead because they don't want you to think it's a jab, yet all the studies are not pointing to that. So you want to talk about misinformation, Mr. Leftist? Look in the damn mirror. Look in the damn mirror. Russia hoax. We can go on. I could do a whole 12-hour show on the misinformation. So, of course, they're pissed off at him. Now, personally, I think that, hey, Meta goes with how the wind blows. It's just awe to it. Whitney Cummings. So Whitney Cummings has faced some fierce criticism from the left because of her performance on CNN's New Year's Eve show, where she just hammered the left. Now she's becoming known more and more for her political and social views with her satirical edge. And she's obviously starting to change. She's arguing that the left wants to silence people. She came out this past week talking about, you know, Trump is low-hanging fruit. I'm going to go where it's cutting edge. But she says the left wants to silence people under the guise of protection. She's finally getting it. And that contradicts the essence of free speech. You're right on, sister. You are right on. She comments about how comedians are too scared. How their little wee-wee shrink up all in and their cojones shrink up to the size of a baby. I can't say anything. I get canceled. And she's right. They're too scared. They're for JJs. When it's time to stand up and they should stand up, they don't. It takes a strong woman like her to go, enough. And she's right. This will lead to a totalitarian society. So good for Whitney. Now, here's what I want to get into. David Muir and his fashion statement. Oh, man, this one's fun. I got to show this picture again. So, fires are raging everywhere. And what happens? David Muir gets caught in a moment of vanity during a live broadcast. I mean, look at that. You can see it right here. He's, I think, I am Mr. Tough Guy. I am Mr. Good Looking. I'm Mr. Suave, sexy. I got to have my clothes form fit. And that's fine. Everybody wants to look good on camera. I've been on TV multiple times. And we all want to get hairs combed. You know, I mean, heck, right now, you know, I'll comb my hair to come on here. So he, during the live broadcast on the Los Angeles fires, they weren't wildfires, they were fires. He used clothespins to cinch his fireman's jacket. That's his vein. And it's not that he did it that's funny, it's he got caught doing it. This is like somebody who dyes their hair. We know you dye your hair, but we don't need to see the roots because then we'll laugh at you. Dude, when's the last time you got your hair done? Why are you on camera with half the gray showing? And you know, it just looks terrible. Obviously, it became a point of mockery and criticism. They called him out for being pathetic, narcissistic, and they criticized the move as inappropriate given the context of the disaster. I think it's pathetic, and he is narcissistic, but he just got busted is all what happened. So when people have reached out to ABC News and to David Muir, would you please respond on this? No comment. They haven't responded back to anybody. It's just too funny, too funny. All right, Keanu Reeves on John Wick. My knees. So Keanu Reeves has some candid remarks about the physical strain of portraying John Wick, specifically concerns with his knees. You know, he says, for those of you not aware, you know, everybody, we all know him as from The Matrix, but he got a second life with the John Wick. And the first movie wasn't even a massive, colossal hit, but it was a hit because it was a low-cost movie. I mean, he was no longer a superstar. Matrix had passed. He was an icon, but if he wasn't in The Matrix, people weren't flocking to see him. Then John Wick came along, and now people are flocking to see John Wick. So he humorously but seriously noted that while his heart is willing to do another John Wick movie, his knees might not be up to the task. He's committed to the John Wick spinoff Ballerina. I don't care about all these John Wicks. We have a Peacock, and I guess they have the Continental, the limited series. I don't care about that stuff. Just give me some John Wick movies. And they got worse. The first one was great. Second one, third one, okay. Fourth one, really? You know, they get more ridiculous and over the top. But hey, I'm a big Keanu Reeves fan because he's such a nice guy. Great. And the difference between him and Ryan Reynolds is stories about how he's helped his fellow man, and not looking for publicity. Somebody who will just tell her, yeah, he was here, he was there, he did this, did that. You never hear that about Mr. Blake Lively, Ryan Reynolds. I'm sure, you know, his PR has curated his rep or his how we see him on screen, but Keanu Reeves is a real deal. So I will always support him. I'll go see what he puts out. Now, I did see the last Matrix. That was a woke piece of garbage. I saw it on a flight, you know, thinking, oh, I'll watch it, and then I'll check it on the big screen when I get home. I haven't touched it. It was been on Netflix. Maybe it's probably still there. It's garbage. It's trash. But his John Wick series is great. I hope he was more humorous than serious. And there you have it, my friends. That is the Rude Rundown, where every week we'll take what's happening in the news and quick semi-rapid fire on it. And there you have it, my friends. I will keep you up to date on Mrs. Ryan Reynolds and her fight with Justin Baldoni, Blake Lively, that is. I hope you enjoyed the retrospective on Rush Limbaugh, and I will keep you up to date on Assassin's Creed Shadows as that game is set to come out next month. And there will be more of the Rude Rundown. Do not forget, you can catch this show at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as our social media outlets, and specifically Rumble, YouTube, Spotify, Pandora, Apple, under the handle Grumblings Media. Also, you can check out my conservative talk podcast, Fired Up, where I have every week we have guests or a panel, as well as my When Sports and Politics Collide, my Points on the Board podcast. And I've got some great topics coming up this week. Is it time for a divorce with the Steelers and Mike Tomlin? And there's an agent called Butler. I forget his first name. Damon Butler, I believe, who made racist comments that are so untrue. I'm going to take that apart. And we're going to talk about the Kelce ESPN show and how nobody likes it or watches it. And who the hell is Kylie Kelce? That name popped up on your screen. So it's a great Points on the Board show. Haven't figured out Fired Up yet, but you can catch all this every week at grumblingsmedia.com and the other outlets I've stated. So, my friends, I am William Del Pilar. And until next week, this is the Red, White, and Rude, and I bid you adieu.